From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a question that has baffled people still trying to make sense of the campaign victory of Donald Trump. How is it evangelicals can reconcile their support of the president with their own values? Or as the reporter McKay Coppins puts it in a new article in The Atlantic, can a man serve two masters? The man reference comes from the Bible, but he also means one man in particular, Vice President Mike Pence. Coppins' article is a profile of Pence, but Pence's life runs in parallel with the fortunes of Christian conservatives. So, back to the question, why do they support Donald Trump? Coppins says evangelicals see the president as just a means to a greater end, and Mike Pence believes he's part of a grand plan. God's plan for Mike Pence today, after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The reporter McKay Coppins has written a piece in The Atlantic exploring how politically conservative evangelical Christians have managed to reconcile their faith with their support of someone like Donald Trump, who is, well, he's not exactly full of fervor about Jesus, let's put it that way. The story is also a profile of Vice President Mike Pence, because Coppins says the fortunes of the religious right run right alongside Pence's own career. And by 2016, both were struggling to stay relevant. But then came Donald Trump, as Coppins puts it, who descended from the mountaintop, offering salvation to both Pence and the religious right. McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. He joined us recently from the offices of The Atlantic to talk about how the vice president is a pious man, but also very ambitious. And Pence believes there's a grand purpose at work, him becoming president of the United States. Let me start with this. So right up front, you say no man can serve two masters. And I'm wondering, I guess, broadly speaking, is this kind of what the story is about?
Yeah. We actually, a little peek behind the scenes, my editor and I went back and forth on whether to lead with that line. But we ultimately decided that it was important because it kind of, in a way, sets up the core contradiction of Mike Pence, which is that he is, by all accounts, according to everyone I talk to who've known him throughout his life, a genuine man of faith. He is somebody for whom religion, Christianity, is at the core of his identity. It's at the core of his worldview. It's guided a lot of his life. At the same time, he's also a man of great personal ambition. And you can go all the way back to his college days when, you know, one of his frat brothers told me even then he wanted to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
And that the contradiction between his Christian ideals and his personal ambition has, you know, I think played out throughout his life. It's also played out throughout the life of the religious right movement.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways, I think the story of Mike Pence is the story of conservative Christianity over the last few decades in this country. And those two masters are kind of clashing now, coming into conflict in very public and dramatic fashion. And so that's what I found most compelling about Pence as a subject.
Yeah, I think there is totally a parallel course between Pence and the conservative Christian movement. And we'll bring that up from time to time because this theme pops up time and time again in this story. Mm-hmm. You give this impression in the article that for Mike Pence and for many evangelicals, they totally get this weird, strange situation that they're in by supporting a president who isn't even close to their identity or their ideals. Mm-hmm. And you say that Pence does this thing when he's in front of a friendly crowd, that when he refers to the president, it often comes with what you describe as this amused little chuckle. What is that?
It's funny. So I first noticed this at a speech I was covering that he was giving in Indiana about the tax policy speech, and I write about that. But then when I went back and was doing research for this story, I was watching all these videos of speeches he'd given on the campaign trail, speeches he'd given since being elected vice president, and And he does this thing where, especially when he's speaking to, you know, conservative supporters, you know, friends in his home state, as in this case, or maybe he's witnessing to evangelicals in a megachurch, he'll come to this moment where he passes along President Trump's well wishes, but he'll do it with this little chuckle that always kind of prompts knowing laughter from the crowd, as though they're kind of all on the same page for that brief, you know, barely perceptible moment. They're basically all acknowledging how absurd it is that Mike Pence is working for Donald Trump, but that it's okay, right? Yeah. We're all in on the joke, but this is going to be fine. And it's never stated, but it's kind of it's the subtext of that little chuckle, I think.
Well, that as you say, Pence is basically saying, look, I've got this, which says something bigger that you report in the piece, that Pence is really looking at the big picture here.
That's right. And it's not just him. You know, I quote a lot of prominent conservative Christian leaders who all look at Pence as somebody who has been placed at the right hand of Donald Trump by God, right? That this was his destiny. There's this, you know, sense of manifest destiny about Pence's journey, and that, you know, just a year before he joined the ticket, he was this, or just a few months before he joined the ticket, he was this small state governor who was deeply unpopular. His national reputation had been kind of destroyed by a series of fumbles in the state house in Indiana. He had once been seen as this rising star in the party, but at this point was kind of, it looked like his political career might be over. And then Donald Trump came and rescued him, and then completely improbably, contrary to what every pundit, every poll thought would happen, Donald Trump won. And people around Pence see that as a miracle. And I think Pence does too. And that infuses his kind of his service under Trump with something bigger, something almost, grand and godly in his view.
It's interesting. You can see if you knew this, that evangelicals and Pence himself see this as part of a grand plan. You see clues in the speeches that you get from Mike Pence. I mean, you mentioned this rhetoric where he says it's time to pray for America, that they will hear from heaven, that God is to heal this land. That kind of rhetoric he's an evangelical, so he talks it like this anyway. But you see that he sort of tips his hand that he believes in that grand plan when you see it in his speeches.
Totally. And I mean, look, to be fair, it is pretty common for presidential candidates and presidents and vice presidents as well to frame their campaigns or their agendas in kind of grandiose terms. You know, famously, Barack Obama in that 2008 campaign would talk about would invoke, you know, Moses and invoke the Bible and talking about the movement that was carrying him to victory. So that's not necessarily unique. I mean, politicians think of themselves as pretty important people. But Mike Pence's specific framing of his own career and the way that he thinks about his rise to the vice presidency, however improbable that it is, seems to suggest that this kind of mingling of his ambition and religion in a way that I think is really fascinating. Basically, he has made a calculation that, you know, certain compromises have to be made to align himself with a man like Donald Trump, but that ultimately he'll be able to bring about God's will. He's doing good by making these personal sacrifices, these personal compromises, and doing things that I think a lot of people on the outside would say are, you know, selling out his religion or selling his soul. He sees as necessary steps to take to be able to enact, to bring about God's will. And there's, you know, people, Pence's defenders will point to plenty of examples in the Bible that support this theory.
Yeah. We'll come back to that because I think that this idea of this servant leadership concept is a big one that you write about in the piece. But let me ask you this. How difficult was it to report this story? I know you tried to get an interview with the vice president. He ultimately turned you down. I mean, but you talked to many others, of course, on the record and off the record, too, it seems.
Yeah, I talked to dozens of people who have known Pence throughout his life. you know, from people who knew him in college, people who served with him in Congress, you know, longtime friends, longtime foes. I went to Indiana. I spent some time on his college campus. You know, I really wanted to understand Pence, the man. And as you mentioned, I did request an interview several times with his office. And, you know, I was told that he, you know, that he politely declined. And one of the reasons I was told by one person close to Pence is that, you know, this president is particularly tapped into media coverage.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He is not somebody who likes his deputies overshadowing him. I think that's one of the reasons, one of the things that did in Steve Bannon, his former chief White House strategist. Mm. So Pence's staff and his aides are very careful about never doing anything to upstage the president, and that includes not cooperating for lengthy magazine profiles. But with this story, I actually found it was much more helpful to talk to people who have known him over the course of his life, because I was able to kind of put together this arc in a way that I don't think that Pence would have been very candid about, just given his position and his natural caution.
So Mike Pence comes across as... frankly, I think to some is this kind of naive, prudish guy. He has what you describe as this aw shucks kind of modesty. But one of the takeaways I have to say from your piece is that, make no mistake about it, Mike Pence is ambitious, maybe even a little conniving.
He's a lot more calculating than I think a lot of people realize.
Yeah. Because
you're right. You look at, like, watch Mike Pence on TV or see him on the campaign trail, and you do not get the image of, you know, Frank Underwood on House of Cards,
right?
This is, he doesn't seem like he's a, you know, savvy backroom operator. But the more I talked to people who've known him throughout his life, they say two things. He's always wanted to be president, or at least, you know, since he was a teenager, before he could drink. He wanted to, legally, he wanted to be president. He also, you know, has been much more meticulous about plotting his career than people realize. And that goes all the way back to, you know, to his college years, his career as a talk radio host. He's always kind of seen himself as, okay, what's the next move?
Yeah.
How do I get, you know, what's the next step up the ladder?
Right.
And he also, for all of his public deference to Trump and his kind of performances of humility and submission and showing himself as the good, loyal foot soldier, there's a sense in the president's orbit, at least among some Trump loyalists that I talk to, that loyalty can't necessarily be counted on long term. That if they ever got to a moment, you know, this has been a presidency under siege from the beginning and certainly since the Mueller investigation started, if they ever got to a moment where the presidency of Donald Trump looked like it was in real peril and they needed to count on Mike Pence to save it, there are a lot of people in the president's orbit who are not sure they really could count on him.
Yeah.
They think that he's ultimately in it for himself and wants to be president. And so it's unclear really how loyal he is.
So let's back up and talk about how Pence comes to his, you know, political and religious sensibilities. And this all starts in Columbus, Indiana, of course, his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Parents were, this was interesting, Irish Catholic Democrats. How Catholic and how much of a Democratic presence was there at home?
They were devout on both counts.
Yeah.
They, you know, somebody told me they worshipped Jesus, Mary, and JFK.
Right. Typically Irish Catholic, right?
Yeah. Yes. No, I mean, really, diehard Irish Catholics. Mike Pence and his brothers served as altar boys at St. Columba Catholic Church. This was really at the core of their family's identity. But what's interesting that I found was that Mike, when he was younger, Pence didn't really thrive in this kind of Norman Rockwell-esque setting. Not because he was necessarily a rebel or anything, but this was a very kind of old-fashioned town where the boys were supposed to play football and be tough. And I found an old newspaper clip from Indiana where he looked back on his childhood and said that he was useless at football, and whereas his brothers were lean and hard and thin, he was, in his own words, a fat little kid, the real pumpkin in the pickle patch.
Yeah. Which I have to say,
I found to be a folksy term.
A real pumpkin in the pickle patch, meaning what? That he was he saw himself as kind of a misfit.
Exactly. Yeah. He saw him – this was – and this is kind of part of the story that he's always told himself. He actually – you know, again, we look at Pence and see somebody who is kind of, you know, the embodiment of a certain kind of Republicanism. And he's – you know, he doesn't seem like somebody who would have trouble fitting in the kind of circles that he traveled in. But he saw himself as an outsider, as a misfit, as somebody who, you know, struggled to fit in the same way and to thrive the same way that his brothers did and that other people in his hometown did. One of the things that changed his life was, and this didn't make it into the piece, but an attentive nun who knew him identified a natural talent for speaking and started encouraging him to enter public speaking contests when he was just in grade school and middle school. And that actually kind of turned things around for him. He discovered a confidence that he didn't have before.
So by the time he gets to college, he's worked through that awkward phase and pretty well. It seems like he was kind of – there are a couple of pictures in the piece. He's kind of a stud on campus. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah. I went through the yearbooks from his undergraduate years. And first of all, he's like omnipresent in these yearbooks. There's photos of him everywhere. He's clearly a really popular guy. And he almost – I write in the piece that it's almost a – he's kind of a campus cliche, the like dark-haired, square-jawed guy who you might find on the quad strumming a guitar and leading like co-eds in a sing-along. You know, he really, you know, there are pictures of him with girls are always around him. He seemed like the big man on campus, and one of his frat brothers who I talked to confirmed that, said, you know, he was really popular. Everybody liked him.
Hmm. Was he much of a partier? At least in, before he comes to this religious conversion, which we'll get to?
Well, he became the president of his fraternity as a sophomore, which was really unusual. But he just, you know, befriended everybody and was kind of a natural fit to be the president of the fraternity. What I'm told is that he wasn't a very hard partier. One person told me he was the kind of guy who would nurse a beer while everybody else was getting drunk. But he did kind of he gamely presided over the frat parties that were thrown and would often be called upon to kind of clean up with the administration whenever the fraternity got in trouble.
But this is a story that's really interesting, though, and I don't know what to make of it from his time in college. So it's during this frat kegger there at the Phi Gamma fraternity. He basically rats his brothers out during this party, and I'm not sure what to make of it. It shows on one hand a kind of ambition. I don't know. Tell the story because I think it's interesting.
Right. Well, so this fraternity, the Phi Gamma Delta, was having this rowdy party one night. And they got word through this network of campus lookouts that they had established that an administrator, an associate dean, was headed toward the house to bust them. And so all the frat brothers, you know, scrambled to hide the kegs and the plastic cups. And then Pence meets the administrator at the door. And the administrator says, "We know you've got a keg." And typically when scenes like this played out, one of the frat brothers would actually take the fall and say, "All this booze is mine," and that would spare the fraternity house from formal discipline because they could only punish one person. Pence instead just led the dean straight to the kegs and admitted they belonged to the fraternity.
Right.
And actually, the fraternity did not, you know, give leniency for Pence's, you know, confession. They actually punished the frat pretty severely. And you know, as you can imagine, some of Pence's frat brothers were mad at him. But as I write, he did manage to stay on good terms with the administration, and actually after he graduated was offered a job by the school in the admissions office, which shows his kind of ability to stay on good terms the people in power, I guess.
But it also shows his opportunism as well. I mean, what did Dan Murphy make of all of that? Because he told you that he believed that Pence's religiosity was a way of justifying this ambition to himself.
Well, and this was a more general observation that he made, which I thought was really interesting. Dan Murphy being his fraternity brother, right, and friend from those college years. He said, he told me, somewhere in the midst of all that genuine humility and good feeling, this is a guy who's got that ambition. And he wondered to me, he said, is Mike's religiosity a way of justifying that ambition to himself?
Right.
Which I think is kind of a key insight into Pence's character. And frankly, you know, just to zoom out a little bit, I think a lot of people of faith will recognize this in themselves if they're being honest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You want to find a way to reconcile your ambition with your religious beliefs, and it can become very easy to start compromising the latter in pursuit of the former. And if you convince yourself that it's actually in service of your religion somehow or of your religious ideals to, you know, attain those ambitious goals, that then you can justify a lot, and that's what I think is part of the, you know, underlying dynamic here with a lot of the decisions Pence has made.
It's McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. His article "God's Plan for Mike Pence" appears in the January-February edition of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the reporter McKay Coppins about his latest piece in The Atlantic magazine. It's about Vice President Mike Pence. It's a profile of his religious and political conversions, but also his lifelong ambition for power. It's called God's Plan for Mike Pence. So you write about these two really crucial conversions that play out for Mike Pence in his college years. Let's talk about the first one. This religious conversion. This is in the spring of 1978. He's a devout Catholic at this point. He's talking about even maybe becoming a priest, but then he gets invited by some evangelical friends to this. I guess it's this Christian rock concert.
Yeah, billed as a Christian Woodstock,
right?
Actually,
yeah,
a music festival. It was in Kentucky. And he actually road tripped there with some of his friends, and it was interesting. So he told this story later at a church, and I found the video of it. But he talks about, you know, he spent the day listening to the bands, and after a day he found himself sitting in a light rain and kind of. Suddenly, you know, hit with this spiritual epiphany. Mm-hmm. And he said, my heart really finally broke with a deep realization that what had happened on the cross in some infinitesimal way had happened to me. And that's where he says that he gave his life to Jesus and basically was born again, became an evangelical Christian.
Really disappoints his mom, I guess.
Well, right. I mean, this was actually a controversial thing within his family and remains so. His family is still very Catholic. All of his brothers, his parents, his mom, they're all Catholics, and he is, he's born again. Obviously, he's been very, thoughtful and considerate of his family's faith. But what's interesting is that while he was born again at this moment, it seems like this was something he struggled with for a while, this conversion, because for a while in the 90s, I would find interviews with him where he would describe himself as an evangelical Catholic,
right.
Where he was kind of trying to straddle those two worlds. So the conversion wasn't exactly immediate. And I think a lot of people who have experiences with faith will recognize that, you know, you might go through a period where you're trying to blend two different traditions in a way to, you know, satisfy parents or other people in your life.
And you say in the piece that he has in some ways kept the details of his spiritual conversion and his spiritual journey pretty opaque.
Yeah, it's interesting because he's obviously a very, you know, publicly pious guy. But he doesn't answer questions about you know, how he finally decided to leave Catholicism and why. I found all kinds of stories where reporters tried to get those answers and just couldn't. But one interesting thing, though, about his religious conversion and the way he kind of straddled Catholicism and evangelical Christianity is that it kind of it kind of embodies the way that the religious right movement formed in this country, which is that especially in the, you know, 80s and 90s, as kind of secular forces were growing more influential in American politics, as conservative Christians of all denominational stripes started to feel more under siege in the culture wars, you started to see this alliance forming between conservative Catholics and evangelicals and other, you know, conservative Jews, other conservative faith traditions, where they basically linked arms and said, look, we have a lot of differences that are theological, but when it comes to politics and when it comes to culture, we're on the same page, and we need to, you know, to link arms and exert our influence together. Yeah. And so, in a way, Pence's, you know, interesting and kind of twisty, turny spiritual evolution does kind of show how that political movement came to be so powerful in this country.
But of course, that wasn't the only conversion Pence had in college. We mentioned, you know, he came from this family of Irish Catholic Democrats. And so going in to college, I guess he was a fairly committed Democrat. And there's this fascinating story that you tell about how the election of 1980, of course, it's between Jimmy Carter, a good, you know, born again Christian, and Ronald Reagan, who, of course, was known for being a movie star. And let's quote Pence, as you do in the piece. This was, he saw it at the time as this struggle between, as he put it, a good Christian, Carter, and a vacuous movie star. And I think him being disdainful of a movie star is all the more interesting when you look at his support of, you know, a reality TV star turned president.
Well, that's totally, I that really stuck out to me. I actually write in the piece that he was ultimately won over. He became a Republican because of Ronald Reagan,
yeah,
and Ronald Reagan's presidency. But I wrote that Reagan instilled in him an appreciation for both movement conservatism and the leadership potential of vacuous entertainers.
Right.
Both of which apparently served him well later in life, right?
Yeah. So you say Mike Pence believes that the fact that he is where he is now is a miracle. So we should talk about his political fortunes. It wasn't that long ago that he seemed pretty played out. As you put it, he was an embattled small state governor, underwater approval ratings, national reputation in tatters. But then things shift. Maybe talk a little bit about his failed political attempts, because I find them really interesting, and especially how his first attempt at trying to run for office, he's really nice and kind of goofy, and that doesn't work. And then he tries to go negative.
Yeah, that's right. So he ran for Congress twice, back to back in 1988 and 1990. And yeah, the first time, he's 29 years old, and he runs for Congress in Indiana. And his gimmick is that he dons short shorts and sneakers and rides a bicycle around the district, getting to know people on the sidewalk and you know, introducing himself to voters. And it was, like, you know, very earnest and kind of cheesy, but, you know, he was cultivating this image as the wholesome boy next door, you know, who wanted to go to Congress. Okay. So it doesn't work. It did, you know, get some attention. He won the Republican nomination, but he didn't win. So then the next time he runs, he kind of abruptly and jarringly pivots to a much more, you know, scorched earth campaign. It's actually still remembered in Indiana as one of the nastiest campaigns in political history in the state. One of the things he did was his campaign aired a commercial with an actor dressed up as an Arab sheik who used an accent and thanked Sharp for advancing the interests of foreign oil. It was a really, really brutal campaign, and it didn't work either. He ended up losing in kind of a blowout there.
But what's interesting about that, I think, is after that, after the negative campaign, after he bows to those tactics, he writes this political essay called Confessions of a Negative Campaigner. And it's really religious. His, you know, he says, Christ Jesus came to save sinners, among whom I am foremost of all. That he conceives of himself as a sinner for having basically dropped into the mud. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was quoting 1 Timothy there, and he really seemed by genuinely repentant for this, for having, betrayed his principles and his values and resorted to these kind of sleazy tactics. And he writes this essay. It runs in newspapers across Indiana, and it actually kind of does rehabilitate his image a little bit. And, yeah. and I'm told that he really meant it. He really felt bad about that campaign. And up until the moment he joined Donald Trump's campaign, he actually stayed true to his pledge never to do that again. Even when he ran for Congress several times later, after that, ended up becoming a congressman, ran for governor. It was a tight race. When his advisors would pressure him to go negative, he would refuse to. He didn't want to be a hypocrite. He actually really stuck to these principles until, Donald Trump came calling.
Yeah. So I have to say, he wasn't really you mentioned he ran for Congress successfully and became governor, of course. But before that, he had this little diversion as a talk show host, which I found kind of interesting. was he any good?
He was. I mean, so it's funny. He described himself as Rush Limbaugh on Decal.
Right.
Which is funny, but actually was like a very deliberate choice by him. Hmm. He wanted to be the friendly, softer, kinder, gentler version of a right-wing talk radio host. Yeah, so he was espousing basically the same ideas. And he certainly, went all in on kind of culture war wedge issues of the day. It's funny, if you look back at his talk show and his essays and stuff from that time, it really is like a time capsule of 90s culture war trivia. Yeah. He's talking about Dr. Kevorkian and things like that. But he always was known for being, kind of polite and respectful to opposing points of view, to the point where the radio executive who oversaw his show actually said nobody ever left an interview not liking him.
Yeah.
If you listen to the tapes now, they're not. I wouldn't say he had the same talent as some of the big stars of conservative talk radio, but it was important for his political future because he became a minor Indiana celebrity through this show. It ended up running in I think 18 or 19 markets. He kind of reintroduced himself to conservatives in the state who really liked him and made a lot of political connections that became valuable later on once he did decide to run for Congress again.
You tell the story from 1999. Pence goes on vacation to Colorado, I think it was. And while he was there, he basically believes he receives a sign from God.
Yeah,
to run for office.
Yeah, he and his wife. So they're at this moment, the congressional seat has opened up. Republicans in the state are urging him to run. He goes to Colorado on a family vacation, and he's horseback riding in the mountains. And he and his wife look up toward the heavens and see two red-tailed hawks soaring over them. And they and Karen, his wife, would later recall that they took it as a sign that Pence should run again, but this time there would be no flapping. He would glide to victory. And that ended up coming true. But it also, I think, illustrates just how much Pence views his career and his political rise as in these terms, in the kind of religious, almost, biblical terms.
Yeah. Because he seemed to be on his way. Then he stumbles as governor. The culture war basically gets the best of him. He's caught off guard when this controversy over same-sex marriage comes up and LGBTQ rights. And And you sort of lay this out in the piece. He goes on the ABC News program this week with George Stephanopoulos. It goes disastrously. Right? And he's dead meat at that point. I mean, and in some ways, and here's another one of these parallels. The culture war is not going well for religious conservatives either. And there's the sense that there's this existential threat. So interesting.
I thought that was interesting that, the parallel arcs of the religious right and Mike Pence, they're almost impossible to ignore once you see them, that at this very moment when Mike Pence kind of found himself under siege, found his political career crumbling before his eyes, it's really right at the same time that conservative Christians are grappling with the fact that the culture has just turned against them on a lot of these big political issues. At this time, it was I think 2015, early 2015.
Right.
Conservative Christians had lost the battles over sex ed, school prayer, pornography censorship, and right at this time, the Supreme Court was poised to legalize same-sex marriage. I talked to Russell Moore, who's a leader of the Southern Baptist Convention. He's a conservative Christian, but is also has been very outspoken in his criticism of Trump. But one thing he said is that at this time, many evangelicals were experiencing the sense of an almost existential threat. And in his view, the triumphalism of cultural elites and secular liberals and their kind of scornful attitudes toward conservative people of faith would inevitably drive them into the arms of a strong man like Trump. And one of the things he told me was, I think there's the need to be a deep reflection on the left about how they helped make this happen. Now, that's a controversial statement, but it's something I heard from a lot of conservative Christians, which was who are averse to Trump but would say, look, you know, people at my church are terrified at how quickly the country has changed, at how fast the culture has seemed to turn against them. And you had somebody like Donald Trump here offering to save them, to protect them. And that was very appealing. And as we'll talk about, I'm sure, it was also very appealing to Mike Pence in his moment of political desperation.
Absolutely. Basically, deliverance comes. It's a miracle. I mean, if you're a conservative Christian, if you're Mike Pence, Donald Trump considering Mike Pence seems like a miracle. And they get along okay, but then this fascinating thing happens in July. Trump is trying to decide between Chris Christie, who he has more of an affinity for obvious reasons. We don't need to lay out why. than this deeply conservative guy from the Midwest, Mike Pence. But then it seems like a miracle happens. Trump's campaign plane needs some repairs or something and has to stay in Indiana for an extra night.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that. That's not exactly how it played out, but it seems like a miracle.
Yeah, so it seems like what it seemed like at the time was that Trump's plane broke down during a quick campaign swing through Indiana, which meant that Trump would need to spend the night in Indianapolis. And with nowhere else to go, the Pences invite him out to or invite him to dinner, and Trump accepts. And it kind of gives Pence one more chance to pitch himself to Trump. And it works. A couple days later, Trump announces Pence as his running mate. And so it kind of seems like this was a moment of divine intervention. In fact, it was a moment of Paul Manafort's intervention.
Right.
As I report in the piece, he was then serving as the campaign's chairman. And he had actually just made up this story about the plane being broken down so that he could keep Trump in town an extra day and give Pence a chance to woo him. It's kind of a remarkable bit of handling, but I think also kind of previews the way that we've seen reported that a lot of Trump's advisors, even in the White House, have kind of found ways to trick him into doing the things that they want him to do.
You say in the article that people who were close to Pence say that he really didn't feel a conflict between his campaign duties and his religious beliefs. And this leads us into this really interesting, I guess, scriptural concept called servant leadership. Explain this. This is really interesting.
Yeah. So this is described to me by Mark Short, who works in the White House and is a longtime aide to Mike Pence, also a fellow Christian. what he told me is that evangelicals have this biblical concept called servant leadership that's modeled after Jesus, who, you know, taught humility by washing his disciples' feet and taught in the New Testament Gospels, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave. The idea basically is that leaders should have a servant's attitude, and that has been a key part of Pence's career. I'm told that when he was in Congress, he would tell his aides to have a servant's attitude when dealing with constituents. And that makes sense. That's a pretty uncontroversial application of Jesus' teaching.
Yeah.
What then becomes a little strange is that later he when he's in Congress, he becomes chairman of the House Republican Conference, and he saw his job as being a servant to his fellow Republican lawmakers. And then when he accepted the vice presidential nomination, he believed he was committing to basically humbly serve Donald Trump and submit to his will.
Yeah.
And this is how I'm told that he kind of justifies doing some of the more unseemly things or undignified things that Trump asks him to do, whether that means, you know, flying across the country to go to an NFL game just so he can walk out in protest of, you know, players who are kneeling during the national anthem, or it means, you know, going on TV and spinning and trying to clean up whatever the latest provocation or outrage that President Trump has done. Pence sees that all as part of this servant leadership idea, that he's here to serve Trump. Trump has authority over him. Another close friend of Pence's explained it to me this way. He said, his faith teaches that you're under authority at all times. Christ is under God's authority. Man is under Christ's authority. Children are under their parents' authority. And employees are under their employer's authority. Pence obviously sees himself as under Trump's authority. And that's how he kind of justifies a lot of the things that he does.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, God's Plan for Mike Pence, appears in the magazine's January-February edition. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist McKay Coppins. We're talking about his latest piece in The Atlantic. It's called God's Plan for Mike Pence. The Access Hollywood tape comes out in October of 2016, and his wife is just completely disgusted by it. And you say in the piece that there's a moment when he thinks he might go – when the Trump campaign officials think that – Pence is going to go rogue. I mean, he's not returning phone calls for a time. There's some talk that he may have even sent a letter to the president, to Donald Trump at the time, saying, look, I need to think about all of this. And one of the things you report exclusively is that Mike Pence may have, in fact, had a coup in mind.
Yeah, so this is kind of remarkable, but apparently you have to remember during those 48 hours that followed the release of the Access Hollywood tape, really nobody knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
The campaign had been completely upended. Republicans across the country were calling on Trump to drop out. You know, editorial boards at conservative papers were calling on him to resign his candidacy. And what I report, according to several Republicans familiar with the situation, is that Pence wasn't just thinking about dropping out himself. He was contemplating a coup of sorts. He actually, within hours after the video came out, Pence made it clear to the Republican National Committee that he was ready to take Trump's place as the party's nominee. And you know, this obviously would have been completely unprecedented. This is just a few weeks from Election Day, but there were a lot of Republicans who wanted to see this happen. And in fact, I'm told that during a meeting at Trump Tower the weekend after the tape came out, Trump had, you know, convened a meeting of his top advisors. And Reince Priebus, who was then chairman of the RNC, was there and bluntly told Trump that he could either drop out right now or lose in a historic landslide. And according to someone who was at that meeting, Priebus said that Mike Pence and Condoleezza Rice were ready to step in as the new Republican ticket.
I also point out one other thing that you write about, which I found fascinating, is that there were a group of wealthy Republican donors who reportedly were trying to put together this buyout for Trump to say, right, look, how much money would it take for you to get out of the race? And the answer was $800 million.
That number came from, I'm told, not Trump himself, but a Trump associate. Somebody close to Trump said the answer is $800 million. It's not clear whether Trump was aware of that discussion, whether he was involved in those negotiations, or whether the offer was actually made. But I do think it illustrates just how desperate, some very powerful people in the Republican Party were to get rid of Trump at that moment.
Okay, so we have to shift to what I think is really the critical takeaway from all of this, and that is, in the article you mentioned that Pence's presence in the White House has really become a boon for the religious right. And I've seen this expressed in various ways, that really liberals, you know, there's all this talk about impeachment and the, you know, President Trump's mental health. And it seems like that liberals really should be more worried about Mike Pence than Donald Trump, that in some ways Pence could jeopardize their values more than Trump. And this idea, one senior GOP senator mentioned to you that it's not a matter of when Republicans are ready to turn on Trump. It's about when they decide they're ready for President Pence.
Yeah. Yeah. And that gets at this the kind of radioactive thing about Mike Pence in this White House, which is that in reality, the vast majority of Republicans on Capitol Hill would prefer a President Pence to a President Trump, right? Pence has deep roots in the party. He is much more stable. He's much more predictable. He's somebody they feel like they can rely on to act like a president, to not, you know, subvert Democratic norms. He is frankly just much more popular among congressional Republicans. And the reason that matters is that, as you said, the specter of impeachment is kind of always out there in this political moment. It might be unlikely. It might be unrealistic. But it's unclear what, you know, Robert Mueller and his team of investigators have unearthed. We haven't seen the last of them. And there's always this idea that maybe Republicans in Congress will just get fed up with Donald Trump and decide that they're done with him, right? Yeah. And they have this guy that they really like just waiting in the wings, who has shown, as I reported, that he's not always, you know, going to be the loyal foot soldier to Donald Trump if he thinks it's within his interest. And so that's what I think makes Pence such a dangerous figure to Donald Trump, and makes him such a controversial figure within the administration.
It brings us back, I think, to the original concept we were talking about, this two masters idea. Through your reporting, what can you say? Did, as you put it in the piece, did ambition get the most of Mike Pence? Did it make him compromise some essential values, do you think?
I mean, I think there's no question that he did things when he was asked to join Trump's ticket, and then subsequently his White House. He has done things that he never would have imagined doing. He has said things he never would have imagined saying just a couple of years ago. There is no question that there are times when he is embarrassed by Donald Trump's behavior and offended by it and feels that it flies in the face of his Christian ideals, right? But he is a man who has agency, right? He could decide to resign. He could decide to speak up. He could decide to stop going on TV and defending Donald Trump every time one of these things happens. But he appears to have made a calculation that it's in his best interest. It's in the best interest of his future political ambitions to stay the loyal foot soldier. And that's where I think these big questions that aren't just about Pence, but about the whole conservative Christian movement and really, you know, the role of faith in public life come into focus. Yeah, you know, I write in the piece that people shouldn't be worried that Pence believes in God. They should be worried that he seems so certain God believes in him.
Yeah.
The line between faith and hubris is, I think, a fine one. And it can become very easy for us to justify doing things that, you know, whether we're people of faith or not, it's very easy to place our political ideology or political agenda above all else and kind of lose our ideals along the way. And I think that that's part of what this story is.
Let me end with something. I want to quote you here. During a moment of political upheaval during the Trump campaign, you write that Mike Pence might have thought he glimpsed something divine in this moment of upheaval, God's hand reaching down to make his will known. And there's this passage in Jeremiah in the Bible that Pence often goes to from time to time. Would you say something about that finally? Just this, again, this idea that there's a grand plan, that God's hand is driving all of this, and that's the thing that's on his mind principally, Mike Pence.
Yeah, well, Mark Short, again, the longtime Pence advisor, told me that there's this verse in Jeremiah that says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." That's something that Pence has turned to apparently often throughout his career. He sees himself as, as God's servant placed in the political arena to do his will. And he believes strongly that that's what he's doing. And when you have somebody who believes that, it's really hard to convince them otherwise, because it's not just a matter of changing their mind about a political issue or convincing them to, you know, break ties with a political ally. You're trying to convince them to, you know, kind of disentangle their entire worldview. That's not an easy task. And that's why I don't think we're going to see Pence kind of fade into the background anytime soon.
That's McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. His article, God's Plan for Mike Pence, appears in the latest edition of the magazine, and we have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Thanks also to Claire Jones. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Eileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.